Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast. It is January 10th, 2022. And it's really cold. It's so cold.
So yesterday, God just decided to bring a massive ice storm.
I don't know why you're blaming God when it's clearly global climate change.
No, but God, I mean, God timed it. Like he decided to, you know, we didn't have a great financial year last year. It was actually a pretty difficult financial year last year. And so we need people to be there on Sundays.
It helps.
It helps. Attendance wasn't great last year either, just because of COVID, I think. So, you know, God deciding to bring a massive ice storm on Sunday morning is in the new year is like, I feel like he's persecuting us. What he's doing. I don't think it's right, but I was really upset that he decided to do that.
I know. I feel like you still are upset.
Yeah, I am. So I woke up in the morning. I woke up yesterday, I think. I was hoping it was Sunday morning. I was hoping, well, maybe.
Maybe, they overblow, like they.
Yeah, the forecast was wrong, but mm-hmm. No, you know they. It was under forecasted. It was like they thought it was going to be
just a little thing.
Yeah, and it's you can't. It was like a skating rink. All the roads like a skating rink. So you couldn't come to church because we couldn't drive.
No, we couldn't get out of. Right. I mean, if you had a flat driveway, I guess some people sort of gingerly made their way out. But I was afraid because ours is. A nice little slant, incline.
Yeah. And then we were on a hill. So you can't get to church without going down a hill. And there was no way. It was pretty steep on both sides. There's no way we could have done that. So I walked to church to lead the 8 o'clock service. And the church is about an hour walk away. So I walked half of that. And then one of my assistants who managed to get out of his driveway, picked me up on one of the bell rooms. There was like one artery in Binghamton, at least the one I passed was pretty, it was okay.
Well salted,
and he picked me up there. But so at church, the staff was there. One person lives right next to the church, so he was able to open it up. The parking lot was a nice skating rink.
I should have brought my skates.
Yeah, he probably could have. It was thick. It was not like 1/10 of an inch thick. It was thick, thick ice. So you know, needless to say, we didn't have a huge
turnout.
We had like one person at the 8 o'clock service,
and then ten.
And we had ten people of you total at the
10:30.
At the 10:30, so that's like 1/8 of our congregation, or one. No, it's 1/10 of our congregation. I know it's one.
Don't do math.
If you have 120 regularly on a Sunday, well, before COVID, I'm not sure what that is. But anyway, it was so small, and I was very, very sad. And then, of course, even the afternoon, you couldn't walk at.
So I went out. I went to my mother's house across the park.
I told you, I said, don't do that.
I really wanted to. And it wasn't bad because it was starting to sort of crunch. But I looked around over my shoulder, and then I went up in the air and came back down heavily. And I was fine yesterday, but I feel very sad now. Like everything in my body hurts today. So
you didn't believe me when I came home and I said, thanks to you, Kim, because you wanted all the kids to walk with you over your mother's house at one. Like, no, I mean,
we wanted to eat her chili. It's really good chili. And it was really sad to be stuck at home. In your house on Sunday morning, it's like really miserable. So, yeah, it brings like flashbacks of the height of COVID, PTSD, you're home with your kids,
watching couch church,
trying to make them think that it's not just like a screen, which it is. It's totally just a screen. And then they talk and shout over what's going on and comment freely about their thoughts on divine liturgy. It's really miserable. So, and incidentally, I read this morning, you read this morning that 600,000 people have left New York.
Yeah. No.
I can't imagine.
California and New York.
Together.
Right. So 360,000 have left New York. And mostly from high taxes. And
still a lot of people.
The clear solution is to.
Well, the weather.
Raise taxes.
The weather is.
Well, this is what this is going to happen. Right? Yeah. Because there's now fewer people in New York State. That means revenue is going to go down. And so the legislature is going to say, oh, we need to raise taxes more.
They've all left to places where there's fewer taxes. We must
raise more taxes.
Raise more taxes.
Everyone's going to run away from the state. That's what happens. I don't really understand the thought, the thinking, but that's how it works in New York State.
Yeah. That's the way that it goes.
We don't have enough money for our
programs.
So we're going to raise, because people left because of our programs, so we're going to raise more money for more programs.
No, this is really. We thought, what were we going to do? We're going to do what was great about the last year and what's going to be great about the new year. Or if we don't want to talk about that, we can just talk about the books we liked.
I'm just having a hard time thinking about anything great out of the last year or this year.
I know you said let's do an episode of
that, but I'm just having my hopes for this year are so low.
Mm. That's good because you can only go up. Everyone should lower their expectations so much that then they're not as disappointed as it's only when you really think that something good is going to happen that you can be disappointed. That's been my theory of life.
My hope is that people just finally say, okay, you know what? COVID is here to stay. We're not getting rid of it. So let's just normalize everything. And
I don't know, the word normalize seems really sketchy.
Just go back to treat it like a flu. Like, okay, when COVID season is raging, stay home if you have, compromised stuff or whatever. But we're not going to have mask mandates and everyone staying home. And that's just, I wish they would do that.
Well, the government is not interested in what you think. So you need to plan that in your head that's not how.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's why I have zero hope for next year.
I don't know. 2021 was a recapitulation of 2020, but I had low expectations and I wasn't disappointed. And I have low expectations now, so I feel pretty cheerful. I was reading a thread on Twitter about people horrified by what you just said, that maybe we could just
go back to normal.
Go back to normal. They were like COVID panic is
right, like people in their homes,
like a thing
by themselves, wearing masks and
still
right.
But that's okay. I mean, people need to be allowed to
be afraid
if that's their favorite thing. I read a lot of great books in 2021 that I like. I'm already reading books that I like in 2022, and my favorite book. Well, I shouldn't say that. I don't have favorite books, but a book that I really loved that I read right at the end as I was desperately cleaning before Christmas, and by read, I mean listen, was the book called Schadenfreude. It's pretty short, and it's a great book. I loved it so much. I'm going to listen. My kids are listening to it, and then I'm going to listen to it again.
What's fascinating that you're talking about is is it Schadenfreude is hardwired into our souls?
Yeah.
Maybe not by God. Even,
but maybe by God. I mean, God has Schadenfreude.
Okay. Well, we should probably define what Schadenfreude is.
He laughs over his enemies. It's the
one
warm
enthroned in heaven laughs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It's the warm feeling you get in your soul when somebody who hates you comes to no good.
But
it's bigger than that. Right. But that's sort of it in a nutshell. But then you can sort of ripple out from there to really all of human society. And so I knew that Schadenfreude was important human emotion that was the glue of society. I think I had read that somewhere there a long time ago. And I thought maybe I had made that up because I felt like it should be true. But this book confirmed to me that that is in fact true. Schadenfreude is the glue that keeps us together in families and communities.
And how does that work?
I'm so delighted that that's true.
But how does that work? How does Schadenfreude make us?
Because it's so many faceted. It includes things like, you know, rejoicing over your enemies. And what is that thing from Arnold Schwarzenegger, hearing the wailing of the women? Is that Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Yeah, it's from Conan the Barbarian.
Oh. But it's also the sort of small comparisons that happen between people who really love each other, which then lead you to either feelings of guilt so that you repent of your sins, or feelings of mercy and pity so that you help those who are downcast. But the first feeling of envy and then rejoicing, that can give way to other better things. But it indicates to you that you are emotionally deeply tied to other people.
I don't understand anything you just said. So give me a concrete example of what you're talking about.
But the latter sort of thing, like the smaller.
Yeah.
Because I think we all understand what it means to feel.
Like, the bigger one is like, okay, every election cycle, like when Trump won in 2016, all the videos of the inside of the Democratic National Convention where people were weeping and gnashing their teeth that were shared around Republican circles.
So even if you weren't happy that Trump won, you were just
watching those.
You thought, oh, they're so sad.
And then, of course, it gets reversed in 2020. So that's Schadenfreude. Everyone knows
that. Yeah, that's Schadenfreude. Okay, but there were a lot of good examples. So one that felt very meaningful to me was the author said that she had a bad day because her husband, she was working on a book draft and it wasn't coming together and she had missed several deadlines. And the day that she got an email from her editor saying, "Where is this wretched draft?" her husband got accolades. He got like an award or somebody said something wonderful about his book. And he was very happy. And she was just filled with rage and jealousy. Now, the reason that she's filled with rage and jealousy is because she does love her husband, but she also feels a sense of competition. And it's such a complicated relationship that she had to stop at that point and say, well, I can't just blow this up. I should be happy for my husband, but I'm so angry. So what she did, so then she outlines a variety of choices you can make when you have the feeling of Schadenfreude.
This isn't a Christian book, by the way.
No, it's not Christian. But one of the things she said you can do is you have to think about it carefully because it could be super unwise to do this, but you could go to the person of whom you feel this deep emotion for him and confess it to them. You could do that. It might be really bad, but she did do it for her husband. She said, "I just have to let you know I'm really upset that you got this award today."
And you have to have like a really close relationship.
They have a good marriage. Yeah, so okay. He said, he could have said, "How dare you?" And it could have driven a rift. But instead, he made a lot of jokes and got her to laugh at herself. And then, and here's the key, they together turned their attention to another writer they really hate. And they rebonded together over their mutual hatred of a third party.
So that's what you mean by how Schadenfreude actually unites people.
Yes.
because And
it makes groups come together in groups to do group really, things.
I'm going to be really sexist here, but I found that mostly plays with women.
No.
The women bond mostly by talking about other women being horrible.
No, that's not. It may happen like that, but I think she covers that in the book, that men and women do have do enjoy Schadenfreude in different ways from each other sometimes. And you can't just say men have it too. They just express it differently. I'm saying it's a great book. I got to read it again or listen to it again. But I did let her, letting our children listen to it.
Sin is so deep in our souls that we like, because you're saying like, you're telling me about the book, how it like, our view of self is formed by this comparing ourselves with others in a way that makes ourselves look good.
Yes.
So there's nothing we enjoy more than noticing someone else's weakness in an area of our strength.
Yeah. And even the people we love best, but sometimes especially the people that we love best, like the people that we're closest to. So here's where I thought it was good, because I probably shouldn't say this, but we do a lot of marriage counseling, and every time we do marriage counseling, our marriage is strengthened. And I always thought that, well, one way that it's strengthened is because we have to focus out towards other people and care about other people, which is really important in life. But the way she described Schadenfreude is like a very subtle emotion. I think every time we help other people, we come away thinking, well, we're not so bad.
That's pretty horrible.
Even though it's not conscious, that warm glow. Because
people come to us when they're in trouble.
They always think, oh, well, at least I didn't do that. And I don't have to say, well, I did do this other thing. So I think I recommend marriage counseling for people if you want to make your marriage strong.
But wasn't she saying it's also like just charity in general, like that, like when you help someone who's in a position of weakness, that gives you a little ego boost, because you're not in a position of weakness, isn't that?
Yeah.
So that's what I was saying. This is that book, even though it's written by a secular author, shows how deeply sinful.
Yeah.
I mean, to the very heart of it, we don't even think about how.
I think that's why people hate the word charity from the Victorian era, because there was so much charity. Like, it really sucks when somebody helps you from a position of strength and you have to.
Yeah, and see, because
I just don't think you can say, like, so Jesus, it's all bad.
His charity. He's humiliating. He's the opposite, though, but he's not thinking, wow, these people are really horrible. Look how good I am compared to these.
Well, he doesn't have to think that because it's true.
It's true.
He doesn't have to consciously say it.
But he doesn't like, I don't know. He doesn't, it's not a, if only our charity could be like Jesus.
Well,
charity.
I do think that's why it's hard for us to accept the charity of our Lord, because we, as they say, map on our Schadenfreude over his, and his Schadenfreude is pure and holy. You can't say that he doesn't it's a different,
like, he does mock his enemies.
The one who sits in heaven laughs. Yeah.
Right. So Psalm 2, right? But
or he laughs them to scorn.
Laughs them to scorn, right?
So you just can't say, well, Jesus would never, or God would never do that or feel that way.
No, but when he helps, when he helps his enemies, he's not laughing to scorn. He laughs to scorn those who refuse to humble themselves.
Yeah,
right. And so there's a, but he does so in a way that's pure and holy.
Yeah,
but in a way that we don't do it.
No,
so right.
But I would love. So I wish some theologian, biblical scholar, would do me a study on God's feelings of vindication, his emotional landscape. And because this is hard, so I've heard people say, well, that's unequivocally evil, Schadenfreude. You shouldn't have that. You should never express it. And my response to that, especially after reading this book, but it was before, I feel just confirmed in what I already knew, which is an important part of this, is that embedded, too basic and necessary a human emotion to just say, don't do that. You should consider the sanctification of your Schadenfreude rather than right. the erasure of it. And anyway, I would like to know
God nailing his enemies to the displaying his enemies on the cross, like holding up to open shame on the cross. That's a great example mm-hmm. of his holding up for mockery. You have that in Colossians chapter 1, I think, it was just kind of the mockery of Satan when Jesus
is dying.
Yeah, yeah.
So he totally subverts it and yeah. turns it over on itself.
I mean, the whole, like, the Christus Victor model, all of it is about this kind of God crushing his enemies under his feet and celebrating his victory.
Yeah.
And then by death, though, it's by his death and resurrection. But yeah, by his death and resurrection. And then it's just coming to my mind is the prophets of Baal just cutting themselves and crying out for Baal to come and help.
And Elijah's like
maybe he's sleeping. Maybe he's going to the bathroom.
I do love that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and then another
which just goes to the point that, you know, I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt mm-hmm. you, but the people who get really, really upset about sarcasm, thinking that it's uncharitable, and it can be uncharitable, but it's not always super, uncharitable. Yeah. Right? It's not always anti. It's not always against the gospel or against the ethics that God would have us employ.
Well, what I liked about the book is it was very practical. She had questions, she suggested that you really analyze your own Schadenfreude, like stop and contemplate it and that of others. It can be a very enjoyable to sort of try to understand it
right
bit better and not just say, you know, or pretend don't, in other words, don't lie. Don't pretend that you don't feel this emotion because you do. You feel it about people you've never met. You feel it about people who you live with. All the different levels of relationships that you have, you're going to feel this one way or another, especially with social media. Like, it's particularly designed to make you have this emotion. So you shouldn't lie and say, I just wouldn't have that.
Right.
I don't triumph over my enemies. You totally do. So you should ask yourself. She has really good questions you can ask yourself to get to the root of it. And then if it's pleasant, she, and as a Christian, she doesn't recommend, you know, just not like confessing. You probably should confess your sins. And God, who is faithful and just, will forgive you from all your Schadenfreude that's wrongly attributed. But I did love that book. It was a great book.
I
recommend it.
How many minutes was it? How many hours was it?
I listened to it faster. That's why I'm going to go back and listen to it slower. But I think it was like 5 hours, maybe. It's one of those, you don't like short books, but I like, occasionally, I like to balance my 40-hour books with an occasional, 5-hour book. It's 4.5 hours. Tiffany Watt Smith, The Schadenfreude, The Joy of Another's Misfortune. Really good. 5 stars. So I thought it was great. Anything that you read, or should I?
Well, I mean, probably not as interesting as that for you or for our general listening public person.
Our listening person.
I get obsessed with historical eras. So I was obsessed with the Hitler era for a while. But this last, from the summer, late summer on to now, I've been obsessed. I had been. I think I've finally satisfied the obsession. satisfied with the World War II and the Pacific Theater, and especially like the way the Japanese thought about it, the way Japanese people thought about it. The Japanese, not people, soldiers.
Well, people, soldiers are people too.
Well, I mean, not just like the way, not, yes, soldiers are people too. Not the, like the average citizen, but the how the soldiers are thinking
about it. Well, they were in the middle of it, you mean?
Yeah. And I just, I mean, it's the code of Bushido, the Japanese warrior code, how it had been shaped from the late Middle Ages until the 20th century to become much more, I'm trying to think of a word that's not, much more, not crazed. I mean, much more
intense
than it had been.
Or focused.
Yeah. And the sense of shame versus honor, and how it was the Americans were shocked when the tide of the war started turning and we started winning, and we would take island after island after island, and you know, in the normal Western way of doing war, if you don't have any food when you left, and you don't have any way to defeat the enemy, and you're a commander and you're looking around at your people and they're all going to die, well, it's honorable then to say, okay, I surrender. Unless you're like, unless surrendering would mean the death of like women and children, or, you know, then you fight to the death. But if it's just a military, if it's just an army surrounded and there's nothing larger at stake, then the honorable course is to surrender for the sake of your men.
Mm-hmm.
Not so with the Japanese. Honorable courses for everybody to die, either by doing, there's like so many bonsai charges, which is when the food is depleted, the ammunition is depleted, they would pull out their swords or put their bayonets down, and there'd be some mass charges into machine gun fire.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and they would all die, and that was glory. That was a glorious thing to do. And the general would usually either take part in the, or the commander would usually take part in the charge, or he would kill himself. He would commit seppuku, which is, you kneel down, you open your gut with a knife, and your second, who's your in the attendant or whoever who's watching, only cuts off your head like at a certain, after you get to a certain point of the cutting. Then he cuts off your head and puts you out, and that retains your honor. Your family is honored by your death. You go to be with your ancestors. It's a weird,
which is important.
Yeah.
Going to be
and honored by your ancestors because you've.
Yeah.
Yeah. Depending on how Buddhist you were, because some of them were so Buddhist they didn't think anything happened. You just kind of go into the sea of nothingness and lose all awareness. But it was just a fascinating way of. There's a really strong sense of fate too, like just this.
So it's not, is it your fault if this happens to you? Like if you're losing,
it's your fault if you survive.
Oh, okay.
It's honorable to lose and die. It's dishonorable to lose.
So you, within and the sort of
or escape, right?
Within the sort of world of fate, right. You could, you had choices you could make.
Right.
It wasn't. Only if God wills, then I'll die this way.
No, it was yeah, you so the Japanese soldiers who did surrender, like they felt just incredible shame, because and they were considered you read like after naval battles, Japanese navy or sailors will be, you know, swimming in the water clinging to debris, and an American ship would pull up and say, hey, can we fish you out? And they either shoot themselves or drown themselves rather than be taken up.
Wow.
Yeah, it was insane. And then the thing that changed it, that began to change it, was just the overwhelming sense, okay, we're going to lose this war. And the kind of the zealots in the army and the navy wanted to turn the whole nation into Bushido. Like all women and children would also, I should back up, in Saipan and in Okinawa, the women and children had been taught that if the Americans catch you, they're going to torture you and they're going to rape you, and they're going to. So they were jumping off cliffs. They were killing themselves with grenades. They were joining with soldiers in their suicide attacks. And so the army and the navy wanted to turn the whole nation into that, so that when the Americans invaded, they would find a whole nation full of people unwilling to surrender, would rather die than do anything else. And that experience is what led the Americans to think, oh man, we can't, if we even try to have a land invasion of Japan, it's going to cost millions upon millions upon millions of lives of men, women, and children, not just so. And they'd already been kind of, and firebombing was a thing in World War II. Neither side cared about destroying a whole city with the Americans and British did it mostly, but firebombing was something that was already there. So American strategists say, look, right, we have atomic power. Unless we drop bombs on in a way that shocks a whole nation,
they won't give up.
But if they know that even their Bushido code, even their like their mass bonsai attacks, their whatever it might be, will not, they won't be going out in a blaze of glory, but just in a mushroom cloud, then maybe they'll
surrender.
Some elements within the Japanese government and the Japanese people will see that it's fruitless and useless. And that's what happened. And they dropped, I mean, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki,
So what's interesting about that is that that's a very fascinating contextualization, cultural context for the atom bomb that is really lacking in history classes. Like when I was in school, they didn't say like the evil Americans dropped, but you didn't have to say it. You just, and then it's like, and then we dropped the atom bomb and there's a pause, you know, and you're like, oh my gosh, you know, that escalated quickly. But if it didn't actually escalate quickly, but it was, a sense of desperation on both counts that drive
island after island. You find suicide attacks and suicides, and the kamikaze pilots ramming their planes into ships, and just a total disregard for death. And you don't know that that's not going to be the way it is.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't it be? It's been that way up to this point. Right. Why wouldn't you find the same thing on the mainland when you land and attack?
So interesting, because my grandfather was he was part of the group that was going to be part of the invasion of, he was, I don't know what I'm saying, he training, or he it, right? was, yeah, he was, it's so, such an amazing thing that he lived through the war to me, that he survived all those, just landing on the aircraft carriers, just his description of what that was like. Is so amazing. Yeah. You think, I can't believe any of them survived that. And it's,
I was reading
about it. Just did it over and over again.
I was reading about the battles that he would have participated in. And he was an ace who got shot down. He was fighting at a time when our carrier based fighter aircraft had finally gained superiority over the Japanese Zero, the F6F. Or 6F, F6, F6, that's what your grandfather flew. And it was superior in every way to the Zero, whereas before the Zero had been superior in every way to the F4, which is the Wildcat, which we used to have. But so when the F6 came out, the air war changed significantly. And the air war, which was probably the major factor in deciding which Navy won, because if you can get your planes past the screen of fighters, then ships are pretty much vulnerable to air fight. So when the air war started turning against the Japanese, that's when they decided, okay, well, we have these planes, we don't have the technology to make them much better, but if we can get one plane past the fighter screens to ram itself into the ship, into an American ship loaded with bombs, then we can maybe equalize the odds. So they stopped training. They stopped having these before World War II. The Japanese fighter pilot was the best trained fighter pilot probably in the world. But it took a long time to produce these superbly trained pilots. Mid-war, you had like a far shortened training period, and by toward the end of the war, then they scrapped it. So you'd have like 60 hours of flight time for a pilot, and many of them were transferred to the kamikaze school, where they would just learn how to crash their planes into. And you didn't have to have a lot of skill to do that. You just had to get past.
Yeah. That's really upsetting.
Yeah.
I'm really glad I'm not reading that book or have read any of those books. Yeah.
Because I always assumed that Bushido is just like chivalry. Mm. And there's definitely some overlap in the way the chivalric code, but there's definitely overlap there. But, in the chivalric code, surrender isn't always an honor. You don't always lose honor when you surrender.
Yeah.
If you fought nobly, if you are not afraid of death, but you make a wise decision not to give your life for something that's not essential, or you can surrender without causing the hurt of weak people who you're defending, then it's fine. As long as you don't do it out of cowardice. But in the Bushido code, it's never, at least as it was in the 20th century, there was never a chance for you to surrender.
Has anybody written about what, I'm sure they have, what the loss of the war, and I mean, because they dismantled certain kinds of their cultural assumptions after the war. I mean, did shame and honor change after that or not?
I haven't read as much about that, but I think there was a massive cultural shift, and it's still like there's still radical Japanese elements in the who hate this, but the shift from the warrior society to a peaceful society did take place. And but you still had like a 1972 when there was a guy, it was a general who called for an uprising to restore the military to the premier place in the Japanese government. And when he knew it wasn't going to be successful, so he planned, after trying to get this to happen, that he would commit harakiri in his office. And he did, and his second chopped his head off, and then his second did it, and his second chopped his head off, and there's like, it was this really bloody thing. But it wasn't just military failure, like in leading up to World War II and during World War II, if you did something perceived as dishonorable, or you failed the emperor in some way, like you just, your policy didn't work out, then the most honorable thing to do would be to just kill yourself, to commit.
That's really,
yeah.
That escalates so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're
that really shifts the whole posture of Schadenfreude. Like, is that a way to interrupt it and make it stop? Because your enemies can't triumph over you because you...
Yeah, you win.
You win.
Yeah, it's a way of winning. You kill yourself, you've won. And
they can never win then.
Right, right.
So you...
Right.
That's interesting.
The glorious dream in the minds of the military leaders of Japan toward the end was that Japan go out in this like blast of glory of mass suicide and mass bonsai attacks. Men, women, and children, and the nation just give itself over to death in a honorable way.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's so, it's such a foreign way of thinking about.
But in the interest of doing good history, a human one, like, because you can.
Why don't we analyze the Bushido code through the
lens
of feminism?
Michel Foucault.
Michel Foucault, right, right. That's how.
What are the power? I mean, that's interesting because power obviously has a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't leave power out of your analysis of human culture and history.
Yeah.
But you can't just say one thing about it.
Because you hear, like, it was essentially about Saipan and Okinawa. Because you read, not just soldiers making people commit suicide, right? It wasn't the soldiers, hey, you're going to do this because it's the right thing. It's
they wanted to.
The people doing that too. It wasn't, it was the ideology went all the way down to the to the base level.
Yeah. It wasn't imposed from the outside.
No, there was a sense before the World War II is that the nation is one people, probably in a way that you and I have never known in America, because we're all different ethnic backgrounds, all different.
We've had to play that sense down as much as possible in order to not have tribalism or not have group identity so strong that you can't have two different kinds of groups together. In Africa, your identity is not something that you construct at all. It's given to you socially by the people around you, mm-hmm. your family and your village. You don't make choices about that. It's not,
that's who you are.
Yeah. So you can't, well, this one thing, I haven't started reading it yet, but there's a book, a history done by someone I grew up knowing a little bit, a history of Christianity, Protestant Christianity in the region where I grew up in Sakasso. And, I haven't started it yet, but I hear that it's really, interesting and good. When the missionaries came, when Protestant missionaries came to the region before the First World War, I think, their cultural assumptions, their colonialist cultural assumptions, how that played out over decades in the region and what that meant for the church and for traditional religion. And, so anyway, I'm going to read it.
Yeah. You've been looking for that book for a while. Is that weird?
I just learned about it. Okay. Yeah.
It was a vision. What was the book?
The Primal Vision.
That's what I was thinking.
That is the best book. Everyone should read that, regardless of what culture they're interested in. You should read it. It's not very long, but it really helps a Western person gain emotional foothold in cultures where I think it would translate across different kinds of, but like Japan or different cultures in Africa, not the same, but just what a unified society, how that is, and what the spiritual implications of that are,
right?
Rather than our very individualistic, we can choose to believe things if we want to, or we can reject our beliefs. We can, you know, put them down and walk away from them if we want to, or at least that's the assumption. I don't really think we can do that, but sorry, I started choking.
Oh. I should have. There's a button on this thing you can push
when you start choking.
When you start choking, you see that red button there. So when you feel like you're gonna like choke,
oh yeah,
push the button, and then when after you're dead, then you're. Your co-host can turn it back on
and keep talking again. We have a thing that would stop pops and but we don't
screen thing.
We don't know how to use that either.
Right.
Well, we've talked for a long time. Do you have anything you're reading right now, or that?
Oh yeah, now I'm starting to obsess over the French Revolution again.
That's one thing you circle back to.
Yeah, circle back. Yeah.
Are you going to map one thing onto another thing?
I'm reading a book called Citizens. And it's interesting. He says at the outset that it's a very long book, but one of his tasks is to tell a narrative history that doesn't fall into the more ideological analyses of the event, which have become
fixed.
Right. And so he's not doing that. He's going to investigate. He's going to do kind of a classic history, and it's really good so far. So,
well, I am still reading The Culture of Narcissism, which I love, and Generation to Generation, which I love. And I'm also binging on Agatha Raisin mystery novels while I clean the house. It's pretty great. And, What else? Oh, I'm reading Mary Astell. I don't have those books on me. Those are really fun. I mean, fun as in it's a high church Anglican woman who in the late 1600s, early 1700s, makes a case for why women should be taught theology. And it's funny. So it's sort of like proto-feminism, but also she's Anglican and believes in God. And she did not like the Puritans.
Oh.
You know, she did not approve of
Mr. Slope.
Dissenters and
right.
Everyone should be Anglican, really. So anyway, I'm reading that when I have time, which now that I've started school and everything like that, I don't have a lot of time. So anything else?
No, we should sign off so we can get along with the day.
I'm not going out there. I'm not going to walk in that. It says that the wind chill factor is like
zero.
I know I said I would walk no matter what, but I'm thinking that.
Well, like so you the hold dogs. It tomorrow, so you got 2 days. You got 2 days where you're just going to do nothing.
Yeah, I'll do something. I'll walk inside. I'll walk around my dining room table. So, well, thank you for listening, and maybe we'll be back next week.